From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The center now presents part two in a series of conversations about the historical and philosophical origins of modern political and intellectual conservatism, with special attention to the influence of Edmund Burke, the 18th century British statesman and orator. The speakers in the following discussion are Harvey Mansfield, Joseph Hamburger, Paul Kress, and Louis Lipsitz. Harvey Mansfield is a professor of government at Harvard University. At the National Humanities Center, he worked on a book about theories of executive power. Joseph Hamburger teaches political science at Yale University. Paul Kress and Louis Lipsitz teach political science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Here is Harvey Mansfield.
One couldn't discuss what in Burke is beyond prudence without mentioning the phrase natural law, I don't think. Natural law is something different from positive law, law that is made. It's supposed to have been made by nature. It's there for us to abide by and not for us to create. And yet, natural law might seem to be something liberal or revolutionary. It had been in Locke's political theory in the 17th century. How did Burke make natural law something conservative? How did he combine it with prudence?
I wonder if we could add one other word to this discussion, Harvey. I've heard a lot about prudence. We've all had a lot to say about that. It's certainly possible to say that the other side of prudence is civility, some kind of deferential public order. But we don't hear anything about justice. And I expect that the discussion is correct to this point, that there is something that Burke has to say about these matters, and maybe natural law gets us to that.
In India and Ireland, natural law come into play because the British Constitution doesn't apply there or doesn't fully apply in those places. So he had to seek some principle which was beyond positive law, beyond constitution, and also beyond prudence, to apply to situations of oppression, which were not in his own backyard.
The British, of course, had been ruling in large parts of India since Elizabethan times, and Burke became aware of terrible cruelty perpetrated by the British regime, as he thought, under the governor generalship of Warren Hastings. And he thought that Hastings was a corrupt governor, and worse than being corrupt, that he was an oppressive one because of the consequences of his policy for the integrity of the cultures of the Indian peoples. And he regarded that as an example of gross injustice, and in connection with that, he introduced the idea of natural law. And he had a marvelous phrase that he used. He talked about geographical morality, and he argued that there was no such thing as geographical morality. In other words, morality that is relative to one time or one or a particular time or place. And by implication, he was insisting that there were universal norms of justice that ought to be complied with at all times and all places. And this, of course, gets close to what his idea of natural law was.
Sounds to me as though you would be describing what today would be called a liberal, somebody who's sympathetic to what's going on where people oppressed.
It's one of the ironies that Burke is known as the conservative, and yet, in fact, he took many positions that today are dear to liberals. For not only did he offend the peoples of India against the oppression of the British, he defended the Irish Catholics against the persecutions and the discrimination British absentee owners and their representatives, the alien British rulers in Ireland. And of course, he was a great friend to the American Revolution. In all these respects, he took positions that today would be regarded as very liberal.
That's right. Burke took positions that were liberal, but on the basis of principles that were not. He would not and did not speak of human rights in complaining of the oppressions in India and Ireland, but in objecting to the French Revolution, he said he was not against the rights of man if they were understood as the real rights of man. But the real rights of man are to particular things in society, to particular institutions which keep society ordered and which protect particular liberties. The general overarching principle of his natural law, I think, is what he called prescription. He thought that prescription, he said, was the great fundamental part of natural law. Prescription means prescription is a way of acquiring property or of losing property by use instead of by title. So when he said that our liberties were based on prescription, what he meant was that we have them because we have practiced them over long periods of time, and not because they can be deducted from some general theoretical principle. And what Warren Hastings was doing in India was to attack the prescripted liberties of Indians. He was destroying customary and traditional way of life, which had many liberties, particular individual liberties, contained within it, Burke thought. It wasn't that Hastings was attacking something general and universal, such as human rights. So, whereas, as Joe said, it's true, morality is not geographic, still, the particular things that are wrong and right are different in different societies according to the different prescriptions of liberty as it is, as they have become active in those societies. Men have rights that are their property over time.
Are they earned?
That they earn and that they have inherited. Well, he's more interested in inheritance, I think, than in earning.
In each of these three cases, the American, sense. The Irish, and the Indian case, it's a deprivation he's concerned about. It is a taking away, I think, of let's call them rights that already were in existence. So that, he's objecting in a way, and this seems in a way liberal to me too, liberal for the 18th century perhaps in any case, he's objecting to the arbitrary use of power, the exploitation by people in power of that power to deprive people of rights or normal aspects of life, like the right to own property, or the right to expect certain ways in the government to behave in certain more or less legal and understandable ways. In that sense, that sounds rather conservative in a sense too, in the sense that he is looking backward for the origin of these rights. That is, they were already in existence. Now, the problem of creating new rights, or saying in another society where these rights don't exist, they ought to exist. Let's create a society where these rights are recognized. That doesn't sound to me quite like the tone of Burke. How, I don't know exactly how he'd react to that, or what would he have said if in the Indian case, the Indians said, well, we have a right to independence from the British Empire. I think that might have been a different ballgame.
Well, I think by implication, he was defending some understanding of independence. As Harvey was saying a moment ago, he was greatly concerned with preserving the rights of the people of India to live in accordance with the customs and traditions and values of their particular society. This implies a kind of cultural independence. Political independence, of course, was another matter, and he was not addressing himself to the question as to whether or not the British ought to have been in India in the first place. But on that, there one can perhaps discern in Burke a position on the appropriateness of imperial rule by considering what he said about the situation in Ireland, where the British were ruling as an imperial, effectively as an imperial power, and about the situation in America, where where of course the British also claimed the right to rule against the. Against the wishes of the Americans.
But Joe, if he's willing to grant independence only on a cultural level, doesn't that really make him insidious in the eyes of liberals? Isn't that a false, isn't that a fraudulent politics to say, sure, you can have your bamboo shoots and this and that and the other thing, but we're not going to let you run your own lives?
Well, I think he did want them to run their own lives. It wasn't a matter of artifacts, as you suggest, but also something so serious to a religious people as their religion.
And also the government of their own traditional nabobs and senators.
Well, how could the British Empire then genuinely run the show if you're going to grant that degree of independence? There's a contradiction there.
That was Hastings' argument. He defended his misrule in India by saying that it was necessary, and of course he's known and rightly so as being the founder of the British Empire in India, and India being the center of the British Empire, you could say he was the founder of the British Empire. And I think he would have argued quite strongly, and did argue, that Burke's principles were inconsistent with the continuation of that empire. But Burke thought not. He thought that India could essentially rule itself, and the British could maintain a commercial presence with what administrative and military support might be necessary for an essentially commercial presence, not much more. Well, but in Ireland, he thought that the British should maintain their rule. The Irish should have, as they did at that time, their own parliament, but that the British Parliament should still have ultimate sovereignty over them, and this because Ireland was too small to protect itself against European enemies, so that Irish liberty required the continuation of British sovereignty.
So what is it we're saying? Burke is the civilized voice of British imperialism? Is that what it comes down to?
No, I would not say that at all. The fact of British imperialism existed, and he was not going to try to eliminate it entirely.
Wouldn't have been prudential, right?
Would have been utterly unrealistic. Mm-hmm. But consider how he responded to British imperial rule in America, and I think that makes it clear, I think, that he certainly was no friend to imperial rule. He was a great friend to the American colonists in their rebellion. He was highly critical of the British for imprudently trying to rule America from across the ocean, and from imprudently trying to take away those prescriptive rights that the Americans had acquired over several generations of what was effectively self-government. And his role in all that has been much appreciated on this side of the Atlantic, and for a long time I believe there was a project in Congress to subsidize the publication of the collected works of Edmund Burke.
Well, that's true, and Burke's famous speech on conciliation with America used to be required reading for every American school child.
I think there's even an implication myself in Burke's writings on America that the evolution of a colony might be such, it might grow so far from the mother country, in a way, that the only appropriate end result would be granting independence. I think that, I mean, he doesn't say this, but I think that there's a kind of implication there that the cultural and political changes might be such that in the end that would be the only sensible resolution. I think that in that sense he'd recognize the inevitable when it appeared.
Then perhaps had he lived in the 20th century, he might have even blessed independence for India.
Yeah.
Is that what you're suggesting?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Probably was very prudent politics, actually.
Yes, that it certainly was. See, the British were being very prudent in getting out of there.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the second part in a series of conversations about the philosophical and historical origins of modern political and intellectual conservatism. The primary focus of the discussion is on the figure and influence of Edmund Burke, the 18th century English orator and statesman. The participants in the discussion are Harvey Mansfield, Joseph Hamburger, Louis Lipsitz, and Paul Kress. Harvey Mansfield is a professor of government at Harvard University. He recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a book about theories of executive power. Joseph Hamburger teaches political science at Yale University. Paul Kress and Louis Lipsitz are professors of political science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Here is Paul Kress.
As I hear the discussion now, it seems that natural law is a moral theory. Or if you're willing to say I think Wayne talked about a culture. Was it something that was simply moral, but it was very dangerous to act politically? And what sort of dichotomy do you think that Burke had then? Is politics simply a prudential matter? If someone makes a moral claim, does that have any force in politics?
Burke would have responded to your question something like this. He might have said that there are all kinds of moral claims that are made, and that we all, whenever we do anything we want to do for whatever reason, like to dress it up with a moral claim to justify what we are doing. And Burke was a hard-headed person and skeptical of many moral claims. Now, yet he wanted to preserve those moral claims that were genuinely legitimate ones. And we could see what he regarded as legitimate moral claims when he saw violations of the real rights of men, as he did in India and in Ireland. And there he invoked his moral theory. But as Harvey said earlier, he was reluctant to invoke moral theory, for too often he seems to have regarded claims justified by moral theory as false claims or as imprudent claims. And for that reason, there is, as we all know, a very deep skepticism about the use of theory in politics in Burke. Thus he appears inconsistent, I would say, when in fact he was not. I would agree with Harvey when he suggests, and with Lou, when they both each suggest that Burke did have some moral theory lay in back of his discussion of prudence. But on the whole, he wanted politics to be conducted without much reference to theory. But when politics got prudential politics did not work, when disasters occurred, as in India and in Ireland, there he invoked his moral theory.
I think he rightly sensed, and he saw it in the French Revolution, that liberal ideas had many revolutionary implications. When people started to talk about liberty or rights or equality, I think he saw probably better than many people that to start to take these ideas seriously meant not the kind of moderate politics that say John Locke usually represents, but that a lot of people would want to go all the way with this. Like, say, someone like Tom Paine, his pamphleteering opponent. Gee whiz, if you start to talk about the rights of man, if you start to talk about liberty and equality, well, the next thing people will be talking about is no one has a natural right to rule. And my ideas about politics are just as good as yours. I mean, who's to say that you should have more weight in political life than I do just because your ancestors did? And then the next question will be, well, gee, you inherited a lot of wealth and you own all this land. Well, why did you have any right to it? You didn't earn it any more than I do. And pretty soon all these questions are opened up. And everything about the social order, particularly all the inequalities and hierarchies in the social order, are subject to very radical reexamination. I think he saw this was the potential of these ideas, the tremendously radical potential, which, in fact, I think is just still unfolding in not only in Western societies, but in the whole world. And I think he perceived this tremendously radical implication, upsetting implication of these ideas. And it's no wonder that he wanted to hold back the flood. I mean, he was unsuccessful in holding it back, but I think he saw what that flood was.
He discerned the potentially anarchical, revolutionary, destructive, oppressive consequences of certain liberal ideas in the French Revolution. But on the other hand, if I may go back to India and Ireland, he, in a sense, discerned certain oppressive and destructive consequences of a certain kind of conservative idea. It was the Tories, the conservatives, that he was opposing in Ireland and in India. And this would suggest that, so we began asking whether or not he's a conservative and what his relationship to conservatism is, this would suggest that perhaps he was not so much a conservative as a middle-of-the-roader, a moderate. And I don't want to disassociate him from conservatism, but his kind of conservatism, it seems to me, is the conservatism of one who is opposed to oppression and dangers wherever they come from the left or the right. And in that sense, he was a genuine middle-of-the-roader, a trimmer, if I may use that word, someone who was not doctrinarily attached to any particular label or body of ideas, but who wanted to defend a good regime from danger wherever it came from, again, whether it came from left or right.
For Burke, a legitimate moral claim is one that arises out of an actual grievance. Something has to be hurting the people. And the statesman's task is to look at his people and see who actually is hurting and to enter with a reform there and not to listen to moral claims that are based on universalities. Those are likely to be inflated and insincere. So look to the actual grievance and apply a reform at that point.
Could one say that he was against doctrinarism, against labels, against theories, against ideologies, and that he wanted to deal with practical matters, the grievances, as Harvey says, where people are hurting, where the shoe hurts, that's where he will set the cobbler to work. And so it's in contrast, he was suspicious of grievances that come from the intellectuals, from the intelligentsia, from the theorists, the speculators, the grievances that are theoretically defined according to a doctrine, but which do not necessarily have a parallel in the hearts and minds, the feelings, the sensitivities, the daily lives of the people.
And the revolutionaries, people like Tom Paine, would say this notion of a statesman reforming particular grievances presupposes that the status quo is fundamentally sound. And I think they would be right, and Burke would agree. For Burke, the status quo is the British Constitution. And he had an attitude of reverence, he said, about the Constitution, where if you don't understand it, venerate it. attitude of reverence or even worship that provided a fundamental underpinning to all his.
But let's not make Burke too parochial by identifying the good society with the British society of his time. For I think it can be said that that the different as our, for example, our society is from that society, or from contemporary British society from 18th century Britain. Nevertheless, there are certain common features amongst all these societies, and for Burke, I think when asked, excuse me, I think Burke would regard all of these societies as worth preserving because they have certain fundamental features of decency and liberty and constitutionality. So I just did not want to suggest that Burke is a parochial figure defending at one particular society at one point of time.
Well, that we know, but the fundamental features of liberty and decency come out through the fundamental features of each society's constitution. So one cannot speak of human rights implying that all human beings have a right to certain minimal things, no matter where they are. Especially one cannot speak of a right to consent to government. I think this is another important feature of Burke's political thought.
So Burke would not approve at all of the notion of entitlements, what we call today entitlements, is that right?
He would approve of entitlements if they're based on a particular constitution or a particular society. You would be entitled to...
You mean a particular practical need?
Not in a particular society. Uh-huh. It's Americans who would have entitlements, not human beings. Americans in our present-day rather rich society, which can afford entitlements, might have those entitlements up to a point, but not because they're human rights.
I wonder, you say Americans, and we're trying to, here's the nationalistic context. It's always struck me that this is one of the most interesting and maybe intractable aspects of conservative thought. That is, that there is seem inevitably to be among conservatives desire, and I think it was true of Burke too, a strong cultural attachment. It may not only be the nation, it might be to a subgroup within the nation, a particular church or a particular region, something like this. But I wonder if this isn't one of the antagonisms between conservatism on the one hand and liberal or radical ideas on the other hand. That is, there's so much more of an effort, I think, on the part of liberals and radicals to think about politics or rights in a way that transcends the nation state. Whereas conservatives, the enlightened conservatives, are not imperialists or chauvinists, but they're very attached, as you say, to the nation. They revere the nation, its institutions, and so on. But anyway, that is the focus of allegiance and attention. And it's rare. I mean, I find it very hard to think of a conservative who doesn't have that kind of focus.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You've been listening to the second segment in a series of conversations about the philosophical and historical origins of modern political and intellectual conservatism. My guests were Harvey Mansfield, Joseph Hamburger, Paul Kress, and Louis Lipsitz. Harvey Mansfield teaches government at Harvard University. As a scholar at the National Humanities Center, he worked on a book about theories of executive power. Joseph Hamburger is a professor of political science at Yale University. Louis Lipsitz and Paul Kress teach political science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The National Humanities Center would like to hear from you. Send your comments to Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.